Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Israeli TV is reporting that Yasser Arafat, longtime symbol of Palestinian resistance and leader of the Palestinian Authority, is dead. But there are also conflicting reports from the Paris hospital where Arafat is being treated for a serious illness. Doctors there have released a statement saying the PLO chair is still alive. President Bush, in his news conference this morning, was asked about the passing of Arafat. He seemed stunned.
My first reaction is God bless his soul. And my second reaction is that we will continue to work for a free Palestinian state that's at peace with Israel.
Well, to try to find out more about the status of Yasser Arafat, we're joined from Paris by Christopher Dickey. He's a Mideast regional correspondent and Paris bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. Welcome, Christopher.
Hello, Robin.
Also joining us on the line from Jerusalem, Washington Post correspondent Molly Moore. Hi, Molly.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. And Christopher, to start with you first, in Paris there, do you have any sense of what is really going on? We have a report that Yasser Arafat has died.
Well, officially he's not dead yet, and he may indeed be on life support. As I understand some of the initial reports coming out of Israel and the Israeli press, they're talking about him being technically dead. So they may not have unplugged him yet, and he may just be in a coma where he's drifting. But it's also conceivable that these are exaggerated reports. The hospitals here keep information very close to their vest. They don't talk to anybody officially except through communiques or to the direct relations of the subject. So it may be that some bad information has gotten out. There's no doubt he's very sick, however.
Yeah. Well, Molly, you're in Jerusalem. What exactly is the press saying there? And have there been officials?
I think more important is what the Palestinians are saying and what they're not saying. You've had almost a Kremlin-esque situation here ever since Arafat was airlifted to Paris last Friday. With the Palestinian officials have been meeting in a flurry of meetings all afternoon. The Palestine Liberation Organization, the Central Committee of Fatah, Arafat's political organization. And so it's very obvious from the activity here that his health is declining, although periodically they come out of their meetings to say that not that everything is fine. They say he's in a difficult situation, but they have consistently all afternoon denied reports that he's in a coma and denied reports that he has, in fact, died.
Well, Christopher, I want to go back to you. You were saying that these might be exaggerations. Why would Israeli television, which is making this first report that Yasser Arafat has died, why would they exaggerate such a touchy subject? Tell me more about that.
Well, I think that there has been a kind of an expectation that he was going to die since the time he was whisked out of the country to France, and they may have gotten some bad information. All of the Israeli reports are coming from blind sources. They're coming from French sources supposedly close to the hospital, or they're coming from unnamed sources altogether. So it isn't absolutely clear where this information is coming from. They say that they've got it from two sources in one case, but they don't say who those are. So it's one of these things that's very iffy. I mean, I wouldn't say it's impossible that he's dead. He may well be dead. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that any of us should run a banner headline right yet.
Yeah. Is it a big risk, Molly, do you think? I mean, this is such a touchy subject. Have people reacted, first of all, to the news in the streets at all? And, you know, is there a risk of having to retract a statement like that?
Well, there certainly is. And in the general, the French general who came out of the hospital and just made the statement, described his clinical situation as being very complex or more complicated. So I think there are some clear signals going on here that Arafat is indeed in very bad shape. Obviously, what the Palestinian officials are trying to do in conveying to the public, they are trying to keep an air of calm. I was out in the West Bank much of today when this news started breaking of the deterioration, and there was not, in fact, a panic among the people. I think a great many Palestinians, certainly a number of those that we spoke with, anticipate that he would not be returning when he left last week, that they know his situation is grave and that he's in very bad health, and that by the fact that he left, many of them were braced for him not to return at all.
And Christopher, we're reminded he has in the past risen like a phoenix and stunned people around the world. I'm thinking of the airplane crash in North Africa, but I'm wondering if that time has passed. And remind us of that story as well.
Well, many years ago, he was in an airplane crash in Libya, and the plane dropped off the screen. It had to be searched for. Several people on the plane were killed, and yet Arafat survived, although his head had been sort of badly hit in the crash. He survived and has gone on to live for decades more. So it's one of these things where people are not discounting the possibility that in a week you'll see him waving and smiling, and he'll be saying, "When can I go back to Ramallah?"
Adding to the legend.
Yes.
Right. But as Molly says, are there many people who are not only resigned to his passing because of his ill health, but maybe looking forward to it and the change that it might bring?
They're certainly looking for a change. The sense of stalemate among Palestinians and Israelis is enormous, but let's not discount how big that sense is among Palestinians. They want to move along. They wanted him to move them along toward a peace that would be some kind of equitable and just arrangement, and he just couldn't seem to get there. So I think that there is hope, but there's also fear of chaos. There's fear that with him gone, the leadership will fracture. You'll have warlords in different cities and towns in the Palestinian territories, and the Israelis will play divide and conquer to create a series of little Bantustans that they can control. So all of that is in the minds of Palestinians right now, I think.
Well, in fact, Molly Moore, in Jerusalem, the Israeli government has contingency plans in place for Arafat's passing. It's apparently called Operation New Leaf. In the minute or so we have left, what can you tell us about that?
Well, they are preparing for the unexpected, and they have been preparing for this ever since last week. And it would involve additional security forces on the edges of Gaza and also throughout the West Bank. But there already is a massive Israeli military occupation in the West Bank and around the periphery of Gaza and in some areas of Gaza. So I don't think that we're talking about a lot more military than we've already seen. What they're trying to do, they'll probably clamp, if it would turn out to be violence around the West Bank, they would probably clamp down even more severely on internal checkpoints and closures on the cities of the type that we see anytime there's any type of disturbance here in the last few years during this ongoing intifada.
And Christopher Dickey in Paris, if Arafat has passed or does pass soon, you say he might be in very ill health. Just briefly, who does President Bush call, and does President Bush make that call? He's already commented on it in today's press conference, but does he call anyone?
I think he would probably call Abu Mazen or Ahmed Kouria or both. He's had dealings with Abu Mazen in that brief period when Abu Mazen was the prime minister, when there seemed to be some initiative toward a peace process in the early summer of 2003. And possibly he would call Suha, Arafat's wife. But I would think that would be about the extent of it.
Christopher Dickey, Paris Bureau Chief and Mideast Regional Editor for Newsweek. We also spoke to Molly Moore, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
And again, there are conflicting reports. Israeli TV is reporting that Yasser Arafat has died. However, the French doctors treating him in Paris say that's not true. After meeting with his cabinet this morning, President George Bush held his first news conference since winning the election. He spoke about that election, saying it brings a mandate from the American people.
I've earned capital in this election, and I'm going to spend it for what I told the people I'd spend it on, which is, you've heard the agenda, Social Security and tax reform, moving this economy forward, education, fighting and winning the war on terror.
Well, the president took a few more questions than he expected to from reporters on a range of topics. And joining us on the line from Washington is Bill Adair, Washington bureau chief for the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. Bill, today's news conference, the president's 16th formal solo question and answer session. Why did he do it, and how did he do?
Well, I think they wanted to start off the second term, even though technically it won't begin till January, with a chance to give an overview of what they plan to do. And I thought it was pretty general. I don't think we got a lot of specifics about some of their plans. And I think that speaks to how difficult his two biggest agenda items, reforming Social Security and reforming the tax code, how difficult it'll be to get those through.
Yeah, we're also joined by veteran Washington political reporter Elaine Povich. Elaine, the president seemed at times defensive, at times bantering, you know, trying to have a give and take with the White House corps. Your thoughts on how he did?
I think he was trying to do two things at once. I think he was trying to show that he does want to reach out to compromise with possibly with Democrats. I think he was trying to show a sort of softer side of himself to the press corps. But I think if you read between the lines, he said a couple of times on a couple of different subjects. One was Social Security, one was reforming the tax code. He said it very carefully. He said, we want to reach out to those who agree with us.
Boy,
he laid that marker down very carefully that said, okay, we're going to start with what we think is a mandate. And if y'all who didn't agree with us don't want to come along, well, fine. But if you agree with us, we'd be happy to take you.
But we're going to talk, by the way, later in the program about what direction the Democratic Party has to take now after their loss this week. But, yeah, now more on what the Republicans do after their victory. Bill, any sense of what that reach out might be?
Well, and I think it's got to be sincere, and both sides have to give some. And as Elaine pointed out, when you say people who agree with us, that is not the beginning of a compromise. And I picked up on those words too, and just thought, boy, they're going to have to do a lot more than just say that they want to improve partisan relations. They're going to have to really be willing to sit down and not say, you know, we have a mandate, and you're either with us or you're against us.
Yeah, well, I think at one point he said, I have the will of the people at my back. He seemed to keep repeating that phrase and yet also wanting to extend an olive branch. Well, there were no major announcements. Some thought there might be. There were none. Bush aides say that the process of finding replacements for outgoing cabinet members is already underway. The most recent speculation is that John Ashcroft, attorney general, might be the first to leave. Elaine, what have you heard?
I have heard that speculation. Towards the end of the last few months before the election, there was speculation that Mr. Ashcroft was feeling as though he'd done his bit, he'd served, he'd gotten the Patriot Act through, and was looking to leave his post. In terms of a replacement, you would probably have to think that the president would look for someone in the same ideological mold as Mr. Ashcroft.
Well, Elaine, I'm going to stop you right there. One of the names that's floating? Well, we'll let you know after we take a break. That's Elaine Povich, veteran Washington political reporter. We're also talking to Bill Adair, Washington bureau chief for the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. We'll hear more from President Bush at his press conference this morning and hear more about speculation on who might be in a new Bush administration when we come back. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we continue our discussion about the near future of the Bush administration. President Bush held a press conference this morning. We're talking to Elaine Povich, veteran Washington political reporter, and Bill Adair, Washington bureau chief for the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. We left you on the note of the speculation about who might replace Attorney General John Ashcroft in the very near future. Elaine, have you heard names?
Well, the name that just got thrown out to me here as we were talking was Rudolph Giuliani. Is that who you'd heard?
We have heard that name. Rudy Giuliani is one of the names being bandied about. Bill Adair, have you heard that?
Yeah, I've heard Giuliani's name. Also, Larry Thompson, now the deputy attorney general. There's also been speculation maybe Mark Roscoe, the former governor of Montana. it'll be interesting to see where they go, because Ashcroft has been such a lightning rod for so much criticism, and they, with someone like Giuliani, they could really, I think, satisfy a lot of the critics, or at least quiet them a little bit.
Well, and
let me jump in.
Yeah,
let me jump in right here about Giuliani. They may satisfy one half of the critics, but the people who elected him are not going to like some of the things they're going to hear about former Mayor Giuliani. I mean, this is a man who favors abortion rights. This is a man who shared an apartment with a gay couple when his wife threw him out of Gracie Mansion because of his very public affair with another woman. If the morality factor in this country is what elected George Bush for a second term, Rudy Giuliani's not going to fit.
But yet, you know, Rudy Giuliani was the president's attack dog, especially in the late stages of the campaign.
And I'm sure the president feels like he should be rewarded. I'm not sure attorney general is the place to go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the other speculation. It's widely thought that Colin Powell will be leaving.
You know, I talked to somebody about that yesterday, and there was the speculation was that he might not leave because there's something of a game of chicken between he and Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, that he wouldn't want to leave and have it be seen as Powell leaving and Rumsfeld staying, as if Rumsfeld had won, so to speak, given that they had disagreed on some issues. And so maybe Powell might not leave.
And your thoughts? Elaine?
My guess is that Colin Powell will stick around for, I want to say the better part of the first year of the second term. I do think this news about the possible death or imminent death of Yasser Arafat will make foreign policy, at least for Colin Powell, even more of a challenge than it is now, and it might be an opportunity for him to put a stamp on Middle East policy.
And by the way, we should say, if people are just joining us, there have been conflicting reports today about the death of Yasser Arafat. Israeli television is reporting that he has died, but the doctors treating him have released a statement saying that he hasn't. But we talked to Christopher Dickey, who says he might be on life support, or so close to death. But that does seem to shift that terrain. Well, at the president's cabinet meeting this morning, prior to his press conference, he sat with Colin Powell on his right, Donald Rumsfeld on his left. What is the thinking, Bill Adair, about Donald Rumsfeld and how long he might stay, especially since it feels as if we haven't seen Donald Rumsfeld speaking for this administration or about the war in Iraq or Afghanistan at all in the last couple of months?
Well, I talked to an advisor of the president yesterday who said he thought that Rumsfeld would stay to finish the reforms that he had wanted to push at the Pentagon that largely got put on hold because of the war. And so, although there had also been some thought that maybe Rumsfeld was ready to move on.
Yeah, Elaine Povich, also at that cabinet meeting, of course, at a very crowded table, Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge and Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta, they've both signaled a desire to leave. That's not unusual in a second term, is it, that many cabinet members want to leave to go be with their families or...
Not at all. It's a very stressful position, very high-profile positions. Many of the folks who take these cabinet jobs do so because the president came to them and they want to serve. But the tenure of cabinet officers is generally not more than one term. There are very few that stay through two full terms of president.
Yeah. And, Elaine, I want to stay with you for a second. You touched on the fact that President Bush was put in office by many voters who, at least in exit polls, said that they voted for him because they feel that he stands with them on certain moral issues or values issues. There are a lot of Americans who are very angry about that. They feel that they're equally moral, and they just have different moral issues. There's sort of been a co-opting of that word in their mind. We're going to talk more about that in a moment. But how does the president smooth that over when those voters who put him in office because of issues like gay marriage and abortion are so important to him?
I think he has a very tricky road to go. You notice he got a question on that today, and he started by saying that, you know, he's the president of all the people, whether they're Jewish or Christian or Muslim, and, you know, try to do a separation of church and state thing. But his campaign deliberately went after conservative, religious right, church-going voters, and he tailored a lot of his message to those folks. So, in a sense, he owes his election to the conservative Christian right. And I think that if he doesn't you know, dance with the one who brung them, if you can forgive my fractured English, he runs the risk of disloyalty to his core constituency. On the other hand, you're right. There's about 48% of the country who didn't vote for him, and I would say a large percentage of those folks believe that he has co-opted, you know, morality, and that he doesn't have a corner on morality, and folks who don't agree with him politically are just as moral as those who do. I think what you're seeing is the great divide in this country between those who subscribe to a certain type of morality and those who prefer their morality in different slices, if you will. And I do think that this is going to be President Bush's largest challenge beyond the war on terrorism, which is how do you unify a country that has divided itself into two distinct camps based on issues that have to do with feelings and religion and morality, not having to do with policy issues.
Yeah. Bill Adair, before we let you both go, just one last question. The man who masterminded the Republican strategy in this election and has done so in the past for President Bush, Karl Rove, was front and center at this press conference today. Is it my imagination, or is that one of the first times he's been so visible?
Well, he's been much more visible in the last month. I was on the campaign trail for the final week or so, and Carl was there and available and talking on the record virtually every day.
Probably feel with the second turn sewn up, no need to hide the fact that he is the man behind the strategy. I want to thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Elaine Povich.
Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine. Elaine Povich and Bill Adair, both reporters. We'll be right back. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Andy, who asked that we only use his first name, wrote after a comment that cell phone users were left out of election polling. He writes, "I'm a registered Republican who voted for Kerry, but my cell phone rang off the hook the week before the election, including one call on election day. So one side of the divide, the Republicans, knew how to tap into cell phone demographics. It didn't impact my vote, but it may have made a difference somewhere." We also got this response from Dave Lewitt of Boston.
I was just listening to your dialogue about what went wrong with exit polling. I think this is presumptuous. There's a discrepancy between the exit polling results and the official tallies. Why can't you just as easily say what went wrong with the official tallies?
Well, most of our letters this week, though, responded to our segment yesterday about the cultural divide in the U.S. Exit polls showed many Americans voted for Bush because he had their moral values. Sarah Cox of Lee, New Hampshire wrote, "You touched on the Republican Party's co-opting of the definition of morality. In my opinion, the Democrats uphold a strong moral value by not pushing religion into public policy, as well as by recognizing and striving to expand human rights and dignity in the context of same-sex marriage. I believe that the Republicans made a poor moral choice in their attempts to use the Constitution to discriminate against same-sex couples, as well as in attempting to restrict a woman's right to choose a safe abortion." Well, what is next for the Democratic Party, given those concerns? How do they respond to Republican voters, but also to Democrats who are concerned about their core values? This week, the Democrats not only lost the presidential race, but Republicans gained 4 seats in the U.S. Senate. In a moment, we're going to speak to Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank about the party's future. But first, we'll hear from Al Fromm. He's founder and CEO of the Democratic Leadership Council. Fromm says that Democratic politicians have to speak to the middle in order to appeal to people who may disagree with them. Al Fromm says a case in point is former President Bill Clinton.
When he talked about abortion, Clinton talked about legal, safe, and rare. Pro-choice people understood he was pro-choice. Pro-life people thought, you know, at least he says they ought to be rare. You're not going to get, and nor should we try to get, the most radical people, radically conservative people. But there is a group of people who oppose, who have different views than we do on a lot of the social issues, who, if they think you at least have respect for them and understand their point of view, even if you disagree with it, you've thought about it, will consider you on other issues. Mm. And for whatever reason, that didn't happen this time.
Yeah. Now, some would say that the Democrats have already let the Republicans redefine liberal, and now they shouldn't also give up the word moral. We're hearing this from our listeners, that being against a poorly planned war, being for a woman's right to choose, is moral. So how do you navigate that tricky path?
It's not easy, obviously, but look, I agree. We can't give up, you know, the mainstream language to the Republicans. They don't own God. I think what we ought to be talking about is grabbing the progressive center, but furthering our core democratic principles. And the thing we need to modernize are our ideas, not our principles. Our principles are just fine, and our values are fine.
But when you say ideas, again, what do you mean?
Let's take an idea like AmeriCorps, the National Service Plan. That is an idea that embodies values that we believe in. It values opportunity because it gives kids an opportunity to earn a college education. It embodies the idea of responsibility because it's not a free lunch. You have to earn it by serving in your community. I don't want to make it sound too intellectual, but we ought to indicate when we talk about our ideas. I mean, Lord knows the civil rights movement was a church-based movement.
Congressman Richard Gephardt told the New York Times that Republicans used their infrastructure of religious organizations and gun organizations to win on Tuesday. So where do Democrats go? Have they also ceded churches to the Republicans?
Well, I think, you know, they probably could do a better job of spending time with religious leaders, talking to them. I don't want to say that we've completely ceded, you know, religion and church to the Republicans, but clearly we've got to do a better job of making clear that our ideas are grounded in our own principles of faith, and that we are a party that believes that faith is a core value of ours.
Who are the people that will take the Democratic Party into the future? Hillary Clinton's name is one that comes up often. Is she on the list?
Of course she is. Hillary is a terrific leader in our party. I mean, you know,
But given what just happened this week, how could someone who is from what's thought to be the liberal side of the Democratic Party, somebody who is already viewed negatively by many of the people who just put George Bush in office, how could she possibly do the job that couldn't be done this week?
I think you're making a lot of assumptions about Senator Clinton. I mean, Senator Clinton was a strong advocate of ideas like welfare reform. She was one of the people who helped put responsibility back into, you know, make it a core Democratic value and the value we talked about all the time. You know, I don't think you can just assume because of some sort of a stereotype that people try to apply to her that she could not. I mean, she's a woman of deep faith, you know, she could very well be the leader of our party.
There's an article that's come out in today's Newsweek. Have you had a chance to read it yet? It has to do with Well, you might have heard that it pretty much says that it's written by reporters who are embedded with both campaigns, mm-hmm. Kerry and Bush, and it pretty much says that the Kerry campaign was in disarray. Do the Democrats who are historically more open to suggestion, more some would say loose with their approach to politicking, do they have to become more like the Republicans, who in the same article are described as almost robotic-like in the way that they marched to Karl Rove's orders?
No. I think the most important thing you can do when you want to run for president, and the most important thing the party can do, is have a clear point of view and a set of ideas and an agenda. We need to see that there are a lot of big challenges that President Bush has not solved and probably won't solve. And what we have to do is come up with solutions that make people think, give people enough confidence that they'll want to turn to us for national leadership.
Al Fromm is founder and CEO of the Democratic Leadership Council. Al, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we're going to hear from Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank in a moment, but first, we'd like to hear from you. What do you think about the direction the Democrats need to take? What do Republicans have to do to heal the divide? As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or remember, you can give us a call and leave a message. That number is 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, your phone number, and your town. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, continuing our conversation about the future of the Democratic Party, we're joined by Barney Frank, Democratic Congressman of Massachusetts. Welcome, Congressman.
Thank you.
I heard you say on Morning Edition this morning, Massachusetts voters are something of an oasis in a somewhat parched national landscape. Is that kind of language going to do what some say has to be done, we just heard Al Fromm say, reaching out to the middle of the country, that parched landscape you might have been talking about?
Well, I don't mean to offend you, but I don't think the people we got to worry about are listening to your station.
Well,
if I was speaking on Fox, maybe I would have used a different metaphor.
Well, you know, you are openly gay. You saw the exit polling. Voters in 11 states voted for constitutional amendments that would make marriage between a man and a woman banned. Senator Chuck Schumer on The Daily Show last night said Democrats have to reconsider stands on gay marriage and abortion. What do you think?
Oh, that he's deeply mistaken. First of all, reconsidering abortion would be a terrible mistake. In fact, I think we are on the public side on abortion, although that's not why I'm there. If you notice, George Bush, when he was debating John Kerry, refused to deal with the question about whether or not he's going to try to overturn Roe versus Wade. In fact, I think that's one of the great dilemmas the Republicans face. I think in general they have a dilemma. I think the public bought their music, but is going to be less happy with their words. When they begin to translate some of these themes into reality, I think it's going to be unpopular politically. Abortion is an example. George Bush will very probably, unfortunately, have the opportunity to appoint justices who will overturn Roe versus Wade, given the age and health of some of the justices. And I think he doesn't want to do that, but he's going to have to. And I think if, in fact, you were able to, if you saw that overturn, people would react against it. So, no, I don't think we should reconsider on abortion. Same-sex marriage, I have the same position I had before. I thought Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco, did us much more harm than good with what I thought was kind of posturing when he announced he was going to allow same-sex marriage, even though the law in California said no. I always thought the best way to do this was what we were doing in Massachusetts. Namely, and this is the case with a lot of anti-discrimination measures, the only way you can defeat fears based in some ways on prejudice or misapprehension is by reality.
Well, Barney Frank, I want to ask you, I think you said half-kiddingly that you would have said something different about the rest of the country if you were on Fox News, but we have a lot of listeners who are concerned on both sides of what we hear is this cultural divide. We have very conservative listeners who told us yesterday, we heard from them, that they felt that the Democratic Party ignored them at their peril. They felt that they were treated like cave people when they talked about their religious feelings. But we have heard from a lot of listeners who feel that the Democratic Party has got to take a stand for what they say are moral issues, you know, standing against a war that was waged without proper evidence for a woman's right to choose. How do you, in about the 2 minutes we have, how does the party reach to both those people?
Well, you can't reach to all people. Look, elections are about divisions. You're not going to get 70%. We got 48%. You know, part of the problem is the media, after an election, It's a quiet period. There's not much going on. You always, all of you, overinterpret the election.
You really don't think there was a culture divide?
May I continue? I mean, like you said, I only have 2 minutes. I can't cover all these complicated subjects.
Go ahead.
You know, I just listened to a six-minute interview with Al Fahm. No, I do think that the media always overinterprets. If you go back, you will find that they always announce that the party that lost is in terrible trouble and may never recover and has to go through terrible surgery, et cetera. In fact, I do believe that the major thing that's going to happen now is the Republicans have the initiative, and I think that they are going to have real difficulty translating these policies into reality. When affordable housing shrinks, when environmental policies turn around in a negative way, when you don't have, when it gets more expensive to go to school, when labor unions get into more trouble, I think this is going to backfire some on them. Beyond that, I think what we should be doing is talking more about the economic issues. And I thought one of the areas where I disagreed with John Kerry was when he said, I'm not a redistributionist Democrat. The single biggest problem in America today is that we are growing in a way that is economically unfair. The amount of jobs we're getting out of a given amount of gross domestic product has dwindled, and the jobs that people have, they're losing health care and they're not gaining wages. I think an aggressive Democratic policy, working with working people, with labor unions and others, for growth with fairness, which has been the Democrats' value added to the table from Franklin Roosevelt on, is what we ought to be stressing.
And Barney Frank, you're going to really hate me now because this is the lightning round. I only have a few seconds. Al Fromm said a Democrat should talk more about their faith and whether or not they pray. Do you think you should talk about whether you pray?
No, I don't think that that's necessary. I think if you talk about the economic issues, that that's a way to do it. Obviously, you ought to be respectful of people's right to pray, and we ought to be fierce in our defense of everybody's right to practice his or her religion. Mm-hmm. But
Barney,
I don't
Frank,
think that the public is looking for religious leaders when they vote for elected officials.
Democratic Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts, thank you. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush held his first post-election news conference earlier today. Questions ranged from the war in Iraq to the so-called evangelical vote. The president will spend the rest of the day at Camp David, where he will lay out his second-term agenda with members of his administration and start thinking about changes to his current staff. He said whatever decisions he makes, he will assemble a really fine group of people that thinks through the issues. And this news note, Elizabeth Edwards, the wife of former Democratic vice presidential candidate John Edwards, has been diagnosed with breast cancer. A spokesman says Elizabeth Edwards was diagnosed yesterday, the day her husband and John Kerry conceded the presidential race. Opera fans are an opinionated bunch, so when a critic compiles a top 100 opera list, you can expect a response of, oh yeah? Says who? Well, says Anthony Tomasini, that's who. He's the highly respected chief classical music critic for the New York Times, and he's compiled his list in the new book, Opera, A Critic's Guide to the 100 Most Important Works and the Best Recordings. Here Anthony reads a portion of one of his essays.
My live introduction to Puccini's La Bohème when I was a teenager could not have been more glorious. It took place in 1965 at the Metropolitan Opera, the old Met in its final season. I had a partial view seat way up in the fourth ring, close to the stage. The renowned Renata Tibaldi sang Mimi, and the elegant and underappreciated Hungarian tenor Sandor Konya was Rodolfo. I remember everything about that enthralling performance, even the fact that, at least from my vantage point, Tibaldi appeared to be actually eating vanilla ice cream during the scene at the Café Momus.
La Bohème is just one of the operas selected by Anthony Tomasini in his new book, and he joins us in the studio. Hello.
Thank you.
It's such a pleasure to speak with you and to have this book, which has already helped me in staying with La Boheme for just a moment. Mm-hmm. You later on write, when Rodolfo tells Marcello that Mimi is dying, you say, translated into the lingo of the 60s, it would be, Mimi's real sick and I can't hack it, man.
Yeah.
Which is what we've come to appreciate. Who are you writing for? Why would you put that in?
Well, I guess predominantly in this book, I'm trying to pull people in, especially newcomers who want some help, who want guidance. But I will be very disappointed if real opera buffs don't find this book interesting, because I've tried to come up with fresh things to say and fresh ways into these pieces.
What makes good opera good opera? I mean, what did you look for to pick these 100?
What makes a good opera a good opera? It's complicated. It's a combination of music and drama. I once wrote a piece in the Times that I was very proud of, where I tried to get at this question of what's the difference between musical theater and opera. And I said there's a lot of overlapping, of course. But if you had to define it, I'd say that musical theater is a musical dramatic form where the mix of words and music is weighted toward the words. Words drive everything, and words drive what kind of songs are written, what kind of voices sing it. Opera, it's weighted the opposite. Music drives. Not that the texts and librettos aren't crucially important, but many people have had the experience I've had. When I was young and I went to the opera house, I had no idea what was going on. This was way before the days of supertitles, and I had no idea what I was seeing.
Well, I'm with you on the music carrying it. I mean, I wept at the end of Dust, Rose, and Cavalier, and I still couldn't tell you what it was about.
Right.
It was something
yes.
about the music, the way it
yes.
turned. But that, just the quick question, Stephen Sondheim is in here. Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street.
Right.
Can Stephen Sondheim hold his own with the great opera?
Oh, right. Can he ever?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, he is not a fan of opera, but Sweeney Todd has more musical sophistication and dramatic integrity and intelligence and cleverness.
Look at me, Mrs. Levitt, look at you. Now we all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Levitt, tell you why. Because the lives of the wicked should be made brief for the rest of us. Death will be a relief. We all deserve to die.
To say again, more musical greatness, you know, than many, many pieces called operas, you know, written in our time. So I thought it would be, I mean, that does bring up another issue about my book, about the 100 essential works. According to whom? Well, it's according to me. But I do believe that 75 of those 100 operas are works that anybody would put in such a list. The rest are my choices. And because I care so intensely about opera as an ongoing art form, I wanted to make sure I included a lot of 20th century works and a lot of works even from the last 10 years. And I made some daring choices, like Gounod's Faust, which is an opera I'm not so wild about, and I think it's kind of overrated. Just to make room for other things, it didn't make my cut. But Busoni's Dr. Faust from the 1920s, which is a very neglected and amazing opera, I did make my cut.
Well, and you know that comment from you will send thousands of people fleeing to find because you
yeah.
said so. Hey, do you, just a last question to you, Tony Tomasini. Do you know how much power you wield to help people, to forge people's tastes?
That's a hard question. It's for others to say how much influence or, my goodness, even power I have. You know, I was a teacher for many years before I was a critic, and I still think of myself as a teacher. At least that's the way I do the job. I try not to think about that I have say over the development of careers or what conductor is hired, or sometimes if you look at New York, I have very little say, it seems. But I try not to focus on that so much and just let that take care of itself. But I do try to educate. I do feel like I can bring attention to young artists, to composers, to works that are new works, you know, or new composers, or you know, works that are neglected or not known about. I can illuminate, I can educate, and that part of the job I love. And if I never get tired, you know, of feeling like I can help. And if my book does that, then I feel I'll have accomplished something.
Tony Tomasini, thanks so much.
Very happy to be here.
New York Times classical music critic Anthony Tomasini's new book is called Opera, A Critic's Guide to the 100 Most Important Works and the Best Recordings. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.